I don't know if Tisha B'Av is exactly the appropriate time, but I want to give a Bruchim Havaim to our next speaker, Rav Spitz, Rav Yair Spitz, who just moved here to Toronto to become the new Rosh Yeshiva at Or Chaim, and we want to welcome him here even on Tisha B'Av and beyond, and we invite him and we thank him for sharing his Torah with us.
The title I chose for the talk this evening is Mourning for the Beit HaMikdash While Choosing to Stay in Galut. Is it even possible? I think the title was too long for the brochure, so I think that part might have been cut off. But it's Mourning While Choosing to Stay in Galut. Is it even possible? And I'm going to spend most of the shiur explaining the title, actually. And if there's time at the end, I'll try to give an answer. But I think the question itself is worthy of to understand it. And I'll start with this story. I actually just spent this past Shabbat at Moshava. Anismo was very nice. I had a fantastic time. And I was reminded of a similar experience I had probably 16, 17 years ago when I was on staff at a different Moshava, not to be named at this point, not to be named. And I was giving a shiur to the staff. I was doing Tishat Hayamim. And you know, the staff, so you're talking about young men and women, ages 18 to, I mean, the oldest person on staff was 23 years old. She was a senior counselor, and she had grown up in Moshava her entire life in Bnei Akiva. And I was giving a class about Tishat HaYamim. I was giving it, you know, like many sichot of this kind in Bnei Akiva Moshavot, about Aliyah. That was basically what I was talking about. And I started off by saying, asking who here from this crowd, it was probably about 60, 70 young men and women, and they set off by saying, who here sees themselves at some point in the future making Aliyah to Israel? Fully expecting every single person to raise their hand, because that's what they've been taught in Moshava. So practically everyone raised their hand, except for this young woman by the name of Carrie. She was the senior faculty, a senior madricha, and I was very surprised to see that Carrie did not raise her hand. So I turned to her and I said, Carrie, would you wish to explain? You don't see yourself at any point in the future making Aliyah to Israel? And she said a sentence which resonates with me always. She said the following statement: when Mashiach comes, I'll think about it. Now, at the time, it really hit me. I didn't even know why. It took me years to fully understand why this sentence, besides the fact that it sounds funny, but as the years went by, I realized it was probably one of the most authentic Jewish expressions I've heard. Not necessarily a positive one, but authentic. And I'll explain what I mean. In order to understand that, we need to go back maybe even further, maybe a couple hundred years. Let's go back 200 years, even more. Let's go back 300 years. So 300 years ago, really wherever the Jews were living, but definitely Europe, but probably everywhere the Jews were living, we lived in a state of, I'd say, existential dissonance. On the one hand, there was the reality of our lives, which was galut, which was exile, but real exile, churban, living in a state where, I'd say, we know we're not in our own, we're not sovereign, we're persecuted, we're hated, we're kicked around from country to country, you know, pogroms are happening, you know, maybe there's a few years where there's a little bit of relative quiet, but really living in an existential state of persecution. And basically, we've grown accustomed, and this is what makes sense, in complete denial of reality. We lived in reality when we were in denial of where we were living, and our heads were in our dreams. Haynu kecholmim. We were dreaming. We were living in denial of the reality because who could... How can you? You can't. You can't exist. We couldn't. We couldn't really exist, really, in the world if we wouldn't hold on to this, to these hopes and the dreams and the prayers and the vision of Geula. And we got accustomed. And the only way for us to survive was to live with this dissonance. On the one hand, almost like, I'd say, closing our eyes to the reality around us and just having this dream in our vision. And everything we do is just because for the hope of this dream to come true. And all of our efforts and all of our prayers and all of our mitzvot in an attempt to reach that dream. I'd say that we lived in borrowed time, borrowed space, borrowed reality. It's, I'd say that a mashal I like to use for it, a lot of mashalim that can be used for it. One of the mashalim I like using for it, it's like a child who is disrupted. I'm ultimately a machanech, I'm in chinuch, so my mashalim come from that world. Like a child who's disruptive in class, and he's disruptive again and again and again to the point where there's just nothing can be done, and the only option is for the teacher to remove the kid from the classroom. And the kid is sitting outside of the classroom and he's just waiting for the teacher to let him back in. Now, while he is outside of the classroom, while he's geographically or physically out of the classroom, a lot of things, other things are happening. He's not hearing the class, he's not learning, he's not advancing, and at some point, he wants to come back. He suddenly appreciates the fact, what he's missing out on. So he's sitting there right outside the door, right outside the classroom, just sitting there, and outside there's, I don't know if you want to kind of make the mashal a little nicer, then, it smells outside the classroom, and it's dirty, and it's cold, and suddenly becomes hot. And some kids are there, they're kicking a ball and keeps on hitting him in the face and injuring him. And all kinds of bad things are happening. And the longer he's sitting outside the classroom, the longer he's exposed to all these things, the more he's imagining what he's missing inside the classroom. Now, let's say you're an observer. You walk by and you come by after 10 minutes and you see he's still sitting outside in the classroom and the door is closed. You say, okay, he's still being punished. And he's sitting there and he's closing, and you see the kid closing his eyes and he's thinking, okay, he's contemplating, he's thinking about it. Obviously, it's not time to go back into the classroom yet. You come by 20 minutes later, the kid is still outside, the door is closed, this kid is outside, he has his eyes closed, hands covering his ears, not trying to listen to all the noise, trying to protect himself so he doesn't get hurt, closing his eyes, just thinking what's happening inside the classroom. And then at some point you come, an hour later, 2 hours later, and you see the classroom door is open. And inside the classroom, the teacher's there. And there's learning going on. And the kid is still sitting outside in the hallway in the same exact situation. He's sitting there with his eyes closed, with his hands on his ears, and he's all bundled up, just thinking, just concentrating. And you want to go up to the kid, you want to shake him and say, look, the door is open. What are you sitting here dreaming and hoping and that you can go back into the classroom, that you can get out of the hallway, you can get out of all these bad things that are happening outside. Just the door is open. Just go in. But the kid can't see or he can't hear. He doesn't want to hear. Whatever the situation is, that in my mind is one of the mashalim that in my mind I have when I look at, and this is where I'm going to make a bit of a leap. I look at the situation, the question they started with. Mourning while choosing to stay in Galut. Whether the kid realizes it or not, you come to him and you say to him, look, the door is open. And he says, no, the door isn't really open. Or you come and you say, choosing to stay outside the classroom, choosing. And I'll make a small kind of detour here. I brought some source sheets, but I decided I'll just, anyone who's interested in seeing the sources afterwards, I'll be happy to give out the source sheet. I chose the mashal well. I try to, because we have a tendency, not tendency, it's a correct one, to attribute galut to a lot of different things. We refer to galut as the physical dislocate, physically being not removed from the land of Israel. We refer to galut as a certain state of mind, a psychological one, a spiritual one, and it's true that there's a lot of different levels, obviously, to being in galut. But I'll just read some of the psukim. When you look in Tanakh, first and foremost, it starts from physically being removed from the land of Israel. Just like the child, first and foremost, it's the fact that he's moved out of the classroom. And because of that, a lot of bad things will happen as a consequence. So just as an example, there's many. I chose like six over here on the page. I'll read just two. Siv is a good example. So in Yirmiyahu, v'nimtzeti lechem ne'um Hashem, v'shavti et shivutechem. וקיבצתי אתכם מכל הארץ הגויים ומכל המקומות אשר הדחתי אתכם שם נאום השם ואשיבותי אתכם אל המקום אשר גלתי אתכם משם. And I will be found by you, says Hashem, and I will return your captivity and gather you from all the nations and from all the places where I have driven you, says Hashem, and I will return you to the place from where I exiled you. So first and foremost, when the Navi is talking about the return from Galut, he's talking about the physical return. Now in the Psukim right afterwards, it goes on to say that after I will bring you back from Galut, then the real work will start. Then you'll learn, and then you'll internalize, and then you'll do full tshuva, and then and every single source that I brought here, I'm not going to read all of them, every single one of the sources that I brought in any of the places where it's talking about the return from Galut, first it says, the first thing that is mentioned is that it will be physically, you will come, I will bring you, you'll come back to the land, and then immediately afterwards, of course, needs to happen the whole big process that comes afterwards. But it starts from coming back to the classroom. How are you going to learn anything? How are you going to advance if you're out in the hallway and the door is closed? I'll read one more, because it'll help me bring me to my next point. This is in Yechezkel. So it says, and there's actually a whole bunch of them in Yechezkel. So I'll start actually from one of the more known ones, which is Chazon Atzmot HaYevashot, the prophecy of the dry bones. So after the long description, Yechezkel is describing what he's seeing. Hashem is asking, what do you see? Yechezkel is describing. He sees the bones that are filled, they're filling the valley, and he's describing how he sees the bones. They come, they start gathering, they next to each other, and then they have sinews, and they have they're starting to come to create a body, and then the body stands up, and the spirit of Hashem, Yechezkel asks that the spirit of Hashem enter into the body. And then, in order for us to understand it fully, the nimshal is given, and the prophet says the following. Here. Ve'omer elai ben Adam, ha'atzamot ele kol beit Yisrael hema. He said to me, son of man, that's Yechezkel's nickname from Hashem, these bones are all of the house of Israel. This is a machloket, this is talking about chiyat hametim, of each individual, but I'm going to stick with the first meaning of it, which is what Hashem is saying to the Navi. Son of man, these bones are all the house of Israel. Behold, they say, our bones have become dried up. When galut, our hope is lost. We are clean cut off to ourselves. Therefore prophesy and say to them, so says Hashem, lo, I open your graves and cause you to come up out of your graves as my people and bring you home to the land of Israel. And then immediately afterwards he says, he continues with the nimshal. And he says, and they go through a process. And it's, at the end, you will stand up and the spirit of Hashem will come into Am Yisrael, and they will call out to Hashem and will be able to, the full process. But it starts from that. In many places, I won't continue reading, but in numerous places, one of the first stages, one of the initial stages that comes after the physical return to the land of Israel is the fact that they'll multiply and they'll become many, and they will be victorious over their enemies, and they will there'll be financial growth and success, and I brought just some examples with me. I kind of looked online, I found on Wikipedia, Jewish population growth in the land of Israel over the last couple of, last two, three generations. So just to kind of throw out some numbers. In 1800, the estimated amount of Jews in the land of Israel was 6,700 Jews. In 1880, which is already after the immigration from, big immigrations from Germany and a few other places, so in 1880, talking about 24,000 Jews. Let's jump to 1915. Goes from 24,000 to 85,000. 1931, this is still before the Holocaust. This is before Hitler. This is 1931, 175,000. 1936, 400,000. 1948, 630,000. I have a whole list here. Anyone who wants, I'll be happy to share it with you. So from the year 1880, or from the year 1915 to 2012, you're talking about a growth from 87,000 to 6 million. I was trying before, and I didn't have enough time to calculate the growth in percentage, but I'm sure someone here can do it faster than me. It's obviously very high. When I read Psukim of Kibbutz Galuyot, and I look at this, I know exactly what it's referring to. It's very obvious to me that when I'm reading these stats, I'm reading, in the Psukim, in Yechezkel, in Yirmiyah, that I know that this is what it's talking about. I can't imagine any other, any possibility of it being more than this. I just decided to kind of look up over some other stats. So as far as anyone know, anyone take a guess? You know, just maybe give a break from hearing my voice. How many registered yeshiva students are there in Israel? Anyone take a brave enough to try to take a guess? 67,000? 100,000? I'll give you guys a hint. It's more. 300,000. You're only a little bit above. In 2001, okay? In 2001, official records. This is not necessarily people who are not doing the army. This is anyone who the Ministry of Religion has down as someone who is sitting and learning. It could be someone who's also 45 and sitting there. But these are, you know, people who sit and learn, and this is what they devote their lives to. So in 2001, the number was 220,000 people. In Israel, 220,000 people, this is 11 years ago, were sitting and learning from morning till evening. Okay, we're officially devoting their lives to Torah. Probably 11 years later, I'm taking a guess, it's probably closer to 250, 260. Never, most probably. The likelihood is that never in the history of Am Yisrael were there so many people devoting their lives, officially devoting their lives to Talmud Torah. This is without getting into the questions of, are they working, are they not working, should they be working. I'm saying just in the fact that Am Yisrael has today, in Eretz Yisrael, more Jews devoting their lives to Talmud Torah than probably ever before. Maybe during the time of Chizkiyahu, there was the same amount, or maybe a little bit more. That's the numbers. That's what it's comparable to. And just for the heck of it, I also checked to see how many registered Chesed organizations there are in Israel today. Official registered Chesed organizations, 2,400 Chesed organizations. So when I read the Nevuot of Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel and talk about the fact that first Am Yisrael returns to the land, and then comes a return to Hashem, to mitzvah, to Torah, to Chesed, to Tzedakah, to Mishpat, and I look at the reality. A month ago I was still living in Israel with my family, where I spent the overwhelming majority of my life, and I look at the reality that is happening over there that we're all familiar with. I don't think, you know, maybe the exact numbers I'm saying might surprise some of us, but you know, I don't think anyone is shocked by the phenomena that I'm describing. So on the one hand, they come and say that, you know, the realities that we were dreaming of, these dreams that we had of being back in the land of Israel, being able to control our own destiny, being able to live as Jews as we like in our own land, with everything that goes with that. For thousands of years, we were dreaming of this. We were praying for it. And Tisha B'Av, that's what Tisha B'Av is. No, that's the core of what Tisha B'Av is about. It's Churban Beit HaMikdash and everything that comes afterwards. Everything that came as a result of it. All of the horrible things that have happened. All of exile as a whole, as well as many, as we all know, as well as many specific events during the exile. We attribute that all back to Churban Beit HaMikdash. That's the moment where it all started. So I come back to my question. How do you live in Chutz Aretz? And how do you mourn? How do you honestly mourn for Galut and for Beit HaMikdash while choosing to stay in Galut? This is a question that could not have been asked in Russia 40 years ago. Because it was not a choice. But this is a difficult choice. A difficult question. But I think one that needs to be asked. How do you live in a place, in a time and a place, in an era where it's 11 hours? 11? 10? Direct flight. 11 hours away. And for the amount of money that we spend on groceries and shopping every month. So how do you mourn honestly while choosing to stay in Galut? So up to here, really, I could really have stopped now. I could stop now and just leave the question hanging in the air and maybe leave it for everyone to answer on their own. But I'll risk it and I'll try to give an answer. I think there are three possible responses to the question. Because I imagine that this question, maybe I'm just emphasizing it, but I would like to think that every honest Jew has thought about it already. And by the way, this is why I I thought that Carrie, that young woman from the beginning of, you know, from that story from camp, was honest. I'll get to that in a second. So I think there are three possible responses. One is to continue being like that child who's just has his eyes closed and his ears covered, and he's living in a, continue living with a dissonance and basically denying reality, continuing what we've done throughout Galut, where we were forced. It was a defense mechanism. We were forced to deny the reality around us. We couldn't let the reality around us in Galut penetrate. Because if we did, we'd be lost. The only thing we had to hold on to was to close our eyes, grit our teeth, and pray for it to be over. And do our job, focus on what we're supposed to do, and hope and hope and pray for the day that it's over. So one possible response is to do the same thing. Continue doing that. Denying reality. But you know, but if this choice is made, and there are communities, there are people who choose this. But if you choose that, that means, if a person or community chooses, that means they're no longer denying only the reality of chutz la'aretz, of the civilization around them. They're also denying the reality of everything that's happening in Eretz Yisrael in the last few generations. They're denying, and you come up with all kinds of reasonings. Well, yes, there's 6 million Jews there, but they're not really Jews, or they're not Jews like Moshe Tzarich. Or yes, we're sovereign, but what kind of sovereignty is it? Yes, we have an army, but what kind of army is it? You come and you have this. You have this phenomena on the far extremes of the Jewish world, coming and saying, well, you know, there's no difference when we were living under the Tsar in Russia and living in Israel under some other Tsar who happens to have a Jewish name. No difference. But I think this is a result of just continuing what we're familiar with, the dissonance. Hold on to the dream. And in my mind, that image of the kid sitting in the corridor is a very strong one. So option one, which some people, some communities do, is to continue denying reality and continue with that dissonance, have that dream, and have it completely detached from anything happening around them, be it where they're living or be it what's happening in Israel. And you have people living in Israel who can have that dissonance as well, who do have that dissonance. The other option, on the other extreme, is not to deny reality, to deny the dream, to deny the vision. You had this in the 1860s, starting from the 1860s and 1880s, beginning of the 1900s, especially when you had the mass immigration in the early 1900s, the mass immigration to North America. So you had, the vision, the dream was given up on. We're going to embrace reality. Reality is, that's it. This is everything. You know, we can take out Yerushalayim from our historical memory and from our prayers, turn Mashiach into an idea of Mashiach, the brotherhood of men, and all of these kinds of ideas. And that is the opposite reaction. Embrace reality, saying what reality offers is everything that there is, and to deny the dream, to give up on the dream. The dream was just a dream. So that's a second option. A third option is to live with the contradiction, is to admit that there is a contradiction. In this day and age, to choose to live in chutz aretz, in exile, is a choice that does not make sense. To be honest enough to admit it. Now it's not simple. Meaning, it might be simple for me. I came from Israel. Bezrat Hashem, I'll be going back there. So it may be very easy. But I'll explain. There are a lot of things that we do as Jews that I think everyone knows what areas in our lives as Jews we would like to do better. You know, if someone says, well, I would like to, someone, let's say, who we're in a shul, I'll use that as an example, someone who speaks in shul, he says, I know it's wrong, okay, and I'm hoping to fix it. If a person is honest, I think it's okay to speak in shul. Okay, you think it's okay to speak in shul? Okay, speak in shul. Okay. But if a person thinks he knows it's wrong, and he thinks it's wrong, and he believes it's wrong, he still does it, he shouldn't, he should be able to recognize it. Most people say, I know I shouldn't be doing it, and you know, I wish I could work on it, and okay, comes a Shoshana, we'll all accept our Kabbalah, Yom Kippur, we're all going to come and say the things we want to improve, and we will really try, and we will really, okay, but we're not going to be in denial. There could be a gap. There is a gap. There's always some kind of gap between what we would like to be doing, what we know we should be doing, what we are doing. But the first stage is to realize there's a gap. So the third option is to live with the contradiction, but to know it. To come and say, I know that I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing as a Jew. It's not easy. It's not easy because it demands something from you. If it's a matter of stopping to talk in shul, that's relatively, I'd like to think, it's relatively easy. It doesn't demand that much change in my life. You know, I'd like to think so. It's just a matter of making the decision and, you know, maybe sitting somewhere else, maybe davening in a different minyan, whatever. Maybe it's sitting right in front of the rabbi, whatever it is. But it requires relatively little for me to close that gap between what I know I'm supposed to do and what I'm actually doing. But over here, it's a massive, it requires a tremendous amount. It requires picking up and moving to Israel. That we all know, that requires a change in lifestyle and a standard of living and leaving what's familiar for my kids, for me. I have the luxury of not knowing how demanding that really is. Meaning, yes, I made Aliyah when I was 5, so the sacrifice I made was not that great. But I can't imagine, I really can't imagine how difficult it is. But I think it is very tempting to fall possibly into one of those two extremes. And sometimes you might not know, even notice that you're doing it. When you choose, when you read a news column, and you choose to understand this as being as tainting the image of Israel in our own minds or in our community, or it's in. First of all, it's living. That's my solution. But I'll expand in a minute. To admit, first of all, that you're living in a contradiction. That when we mourn on Tisha B'Av, we're mourning. Not for something just that was, I'll give another, something that came to mind just a couple of days ago. So the word in Hebrew for mourning is obviously avilut, right? There's something a little strange because avilut you do once someone is dead already. When there's nothing really to do. When it's too, right? When a person is sick, you're not avel, you work. You try to help them, you try to revive them, you're avel once it's done, that's it. And that is a very appropriate image for 1800 years of Galut. There's really nothing we could do other than mourn and other than obviously go about doing our business as Jews and improving in our Shemirat Torah Mitzvot, our Ben Adam L'Chaveru especially, you know, Chumran Bayit Sheni, and to do our best, grit our teeth, close our eyes and say, I'm going to try my best. But you're avel because Bet HaMikdash is Nechrav, Eretz Yisrael is destroyed. There's really nothing that you can do, but you as an individual, you can't go and build Beit HaMikdash. You can't go and build the land of Israel. You can't go and gather all the exiles. Well, let me rephrase that. You of 300 years ago couldn't do that. You of 200 years ago couldn't do that. Today, sure you can. It's as if, going back to another image, so for 1800 years, we were mourning on something that has passed, that died. On Israel as a collective died. Beit HaMikdash and Eretz Israel and all the, it died. We exist as a lot of individuals living close to each other. But Am Yisrael as a whole, it was dead. So we're mitabel and we're gritting our teeth and we're trying our best. But now, it's like a baby is born. And you're still sitting and you're crying. And you're mitabel on the person that was lost. But Am Yisrael, something has changed in reality. Something massive has changed. As I've said before, the numbers say it. I don't think any... I find it hard to understand any other approach to come and say something fundamental has changed in the last 2, 3, 4 generations since the early 1900s, definitely since 1948. So you're looking at this brand new baby that was born, and you're sitting here avel that the person that you remember who was used as a mashal, a big Talmud Chacham and a righteous man, he's no longer there. But you have something right in front of you with this tremendous potential. Now, if some of the things I've said so far sound a little severe, I'm going to kick it up one more notch. There are two precedents to what I just described, in the first Geula and in the second Geula. In the first Geula, which is Geulat Mitzrayim, there were people who chose not to believe that the Geula was there, or not to act upon it. I didn't actually bring it with me, but there's a midrash that says, which is a fantastical midrash. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu comes to Am Yisrael and says, I'm here, Hashem has sent me to redeem you. And they say to him, it's almost unimaginable. It's as if it was written for today. And they say to him, I don't remember the exact lashon, but basically they say to him, it's too early. Hashem said to Avram, right? And they will be enslaved and they will work for that nation 400 years, and it's not 400 years yet. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, you read it today and think, oh, it's like almost like a joke, or it's like, you know, it's ke'ilu. It's not, can't be literally that Moshe Rabbeinu came to the Jews and said, Hashem has sent me to save you. And they said, no, you're too early. We're going to stick around a little bit longer. It's unimaginable to us. But that's what Midrash is saying. And then Moshe Rabbeinu says back to them, I regret it not remembering the Lashon. Something along the lines of that when Hashem decided it's time to redeem you, when Hashem wants to redeem you, He redeems you, and He doesn't care about your cheshbon, of your calculations. So there's the Rashi that explains it actually 400 years. It starts from when Yitzchak was born. But Moshe Rabbeinu didn't start saying with them, listen, you're just not counting right. You should be counting from 190 years earlier. He didn't do that. He didn't feel the need today. He just said, listen, Hashem wants to redeem you. That's it. He's redeeming you. Now we all know, V'chamushim alu b'nei Yisrael meretz Mitzrayim. Right? The Midrash that says that 4/5 of Am Yisrael did not come out of Egypt. They chose not to believe. They chose not to come. They chose not to put the blood on the door, on the door. Whatever it is, they chose not to participate. What ended up happening to those 4/5? So the Midrash says that they were wiped out with the Makat Choshech. But if you go to the second, that's what happened to the first Geula. I'm not trying to scare anyone. When I get to the second Geula, I see. In the second Geula, there's also very similar. Ezra, Geulat Ezra and Nehemiah. Koresh, Cyrus makes a declaration, and he says, anyone from you, from his people, who his spirit was with him, should go up to the land of Yehuda and build Beit HaMikdash. Right? How many people actually heeded the call and went to Israel? 42,300. That's how many people went. The rest decided to stay. We don't know exactly how many Jews were alive at the time, but we know for a fact from the Pesukim that many, many, many more decided to stay. The Gemara in Kiddushin, Asura Yuchsin, says that the ones who did go were like the lower class people. And the people who stayed didn't want to go because they were comfortable and they didn't want to go with all the zhlubs, all the people who didn't have yichus. So 42,300 people came. Beit HaMikdash was built 26 years later, and then 200 years later is Hanukkah. And we do know that with time, more and more Jews did come back, but hundreds of thousands, at least, stayed in Bavel. What ended up happening with them? Anyone here know? I would love if someone could tell me, because I haven't found any record of them at all. Meaning, the Jews of Bavel that we hear from the Gemara, okay, all the Moraim, and all, that's from after Churban Bayit Sheni. Right, that's after second Beit HaMikdash is destroyed. Then you know the Mishnah was written, and then after the Churban, the mass of Am Yisrael was exiled to Bavel, and then the Gemara. But what about the hundreds of thousands of Jews who stayed between Ezra and the time of the Gemara? They vanished, meaning gradually more and some over time, made Aliyah and came to Israel. What happened to the rest? I have no clue. I have found not one reference or record of them. So if anyone knows anything about them, I'd be happy to know. My guess would be they just kind of vanished into history. So there are precedents to the fact that Geula starts, that Geula happens, that Am Yisrael returns and starts building again, gradually building more and more towards the completion of the full vision of the full dream, and people choosing to stay in Galut, and maybe it was one generation, maybe it was three generations, maybe it was five generations, they kind of fall on the wayside of history. I'm just going to hint towards the fact that a similar thing, one could claim that a similar thing, similar parallel can be found in the third Geula, but that's a little more harsh, it's a whole different topic, I won't get into it. Because there were people who chose to stay, also when Tzionut was starting, those who understand what I'm referring to understand, and I don't want to open it up because it's a whole different topic. So, I don't want to leave us with, you know, it's Tisha B'Av and we're supposed to be sad. I don't want to leave us, you know, too depressed. So how does one, go back to the question. So how does someone mourn while choosing to stay in Galut? So I go back to my answer, which is, a person lives with a contradiction. But as long as he knows it's a contradiction, and he's trying, he at least aspires to come up with an answer. A person who says, okay, you know, I want to make Aliyah. I just can't right now, but I'll do it next year. Okay. But only if a person's serious. You know, I've heard it millions of times. Everyone has said it. I want to move to Israel, but. And I don't think that those buts are nothing. I can't imagine how difficult it is. But there's a lot of different things that can be done. And here, here as a mechanech, I'll go into one of the things that, an additional point. How do I raise a child in telling him that Israel is important, and when we have family trips, we try to go there, and you should, right? And when we have summer programs, I encourage my kids to go there on summer programs, and I encourage them to go, and I raise them in an atmosphere where they're encouraged to go after high school to yeshiva. But, and I do that because I believe in it. I really do. Because I know that I'm living in a contradiction, and I believe in these things, and I hope my kids, and I'm sure many people here have kids who live in Israel and believe in it and are happy that they're doing it. But as a teenager, I didn't grow up as a teenager, but I've worked with many teenagers who have, and I'm thinking to myself, there's a big danger if you're living in that in between place of sending a message to our kids that it's all fake. What do I mean by that? A third of Tefillat Shmona Esrei deals with Geula, deals with living in Israel, deals with building Yerushalayim, deals with things that in the past were only a dream, but today some of them are happening in front of our eyes, and those that are not, we could be part of it. You know what? I'm going to say something. If you wanted to build Beit HaMikdash today, there's not one thing stopping us. Without getting into the whole sugya, let's use it as an example. Rambam Maimonides says that in every time, in every moment, there's a mitzvah to build Beit HaMikdash. Okay, not getting to the whole sugya. It's not as simple as I'm saying, but let's say we go with that. All it takes is a decision. It's not a decision that could be made 100 years ago or 200 years ago. I'm not saying that right now we should. There's a lot of things to think about. I'm not necessarily, it's not the time. It's dangerous. It should be done with, everyone should agree on it. All of Am Yisrael, all of, but okay, fine, yes. But is the possibility there? Yeah, we live in a time where it's possible to actually go and build a Tamikdash. Could you be drawing up plans for it? Yeah, there are people doing that. Can you be donating money to a place that's building the kalim that will be used? Yeah, you can, and you should. Meaning, it's no longer a dream. So some of the things are actually happening, and those that are not. So when we say in Tefillat Shmona Esrei, Mekabetz Nidchei Amo Yisrael, who are we praying about? Hashem should bring back the exiles. Who is it that we're talking about? We're talking about ourselves. And we're talking about building Beit HaMikdash. Who are we talking about ourselves? It's something that can be done. So what message, and this kind of opens up a bigger topic maybe. What do I say to my kids? Or what message may they be getting when they see that on the one hand we're praying, And people seem to be sincere about the prayer. They're serious. They go to daven 3 times a day, and we educate our kids to be serious about tefillah, and it's always a big thing. How do you teach kids tefillah? But a third of what they're praying for seems to be so removed from the reality. And I have this chashash in my heart, deep down, that this is one example of something that possibly taints the entire Jewish education that we give our kids. We're teaching them to have this dissonance between what they're saying, which doesn't necessarily have that much value, because in reality, there's this tremendous gap. And they have this fear that it might impact other aspects of our chinuch, of our kids as well. Because kids, teenagers especially, are very good, even without being able to verbalize it, are excellent at identifying things that are fake. They're excellent at it. This is one example. In my mind, one of the issues of teaching kids tefillah is this. How do you make them feel it's real when, by definition, a third of what they're saying seems to be very distant from reality? And I think to myself, possibly, the reason, I go back to those hundreds of thousands of Jews in Bavel, in Beit Sheni, who fell on the wayside, I wonder to myself if this is part of the reason. Not necessarily tefillah wasn't put together yet exactly in that way, but the attempt to have a full Jewish life, a full meaningful Jewish life, in a place that by definition is not meant for it. So I go back to the beginning. During the time of the Galut, the only Judaism we could have is a Judaism in Galut. And a third of the Torah, not even Mekayim. A third of the mitzvot are not relevant. But in a time when you can be doing mitzvot atriyot ba'aretz, where you could start to do things that have to do with Bet HaMikdash, where you could have a full Jewish life, not only as an individual, but as an entire society, to try to maintain a full Jewish life in a time where it's possible to be done fully, but to try to make believe as if it's full and it's complete in an unnatural place and time and reality. I think that this is one of the tremendous challenges that we face with getting our kids to feel that Judaism is something which is real, which is something which is completely filling their entire identity. I think that's also one of the reasons why when you do send your kids to Israel, I was at Ennismore last night I was having a talk with the director at Camp Mosheva, and she said to me, she sees this tremendous difference, and everyone knows this, tremendous difference. The kids, they're working as counselors at her camp at the end of 12th grade, and they come back exactly a year later, after the first year, the year in Israel, and it's like, even the kids were really great. You know, suddenly everything is different. And she said to me, "What's happening there in Israel?" She was asking me sincerely, "What's happening there in Israel during that year that suddenly they're excited about Yiddishkeit and they're enthusiastic about it, and all these issues that we had to be petty about this, about how they dressed and how they act in tefillah, that's it, it's gone. Suddenly they're self motivated. What happens there?" So, you know, we spoke about it, and I think there's a combination of things. But one of them is, I think that you go to Israel, and I think anyone who's been to Israel for more than a couple of days and has spent time there during a chag or for any extended amount of time knows it. You see Yahadut alive, not just, you don't have to, kind of ward off the reality around you in order to maintain a dalad amot, a four amot of halacha. It's filling the streets, it's filling the everything. It's Yahadut, Judaism is walking, talking, it's everything around you. It's the language, it's the calendar, year calendar, it's the soldiers, it's everything. You read Tanakh and you say, okay, you know, this seems very similar. This is what it's all about. So to try to maintain, while that's going on, maintain a shadow of it, of what a continuation of what was, I think that is a very, very, very big risk. That's a contradiction that. Maybe as adults, we can come and say, okay, when I retire, I'll be making aliyah. So, okay, so my contradiction is taken care of. When I go on vacation with my family for Pesach, I'll choose to go there and not to Florida. But I think that the big question is, how do we educate young men and women, kids, young men and women, with this contradiction? I think the only way to do it is to come and say, there is a contradiction here. I know that there's a gap here, and we're going to work on it. We're going to go take vacations there. We're going to learn about it. We're going to learn Ivrit. We're going to in our shuls, and time someone makes aliyah, we're going to make a big deal out of it. This is the model that we want to follow. These are the speakers that we're going to bring in. This is going to be... It's not an easy answer, because it demands a tremendous amount. But just to conclude, and then I think there'll be a few... there'll be time for questions. So how does one mourn while choosing to stay in Galut? You admit the contradiction. You realize that you're paying a price for it. The second is, first is to admit the contradiction. The second to realize that you're paying a price on it personally, as well as with your children. And the third is to work towards resolving it. With all of the different options that I said, and many more that I'm sure that people can come up with, it's not an easy task. But Tisha B'Av is not supposed to be an easy day. It's a day of reflection. Like I said, if I would leave with this image, instead of mourning for someone who has died, to realize that something has been born, and we can and we and we must be part of it, or God forbid, in two generations, three generations, four generations, we shouldn't end up like those Jews in Bavel who just kind of fell off on the wayside. I'll be happy to take questions or comments. Yes. So I'd say, so I'll just repeat the question. I'm pointing out the contradiction that exists here by living here while the state of Israel is over there. But isn't there also a contradiction of living in Israel? But on the other hand, Israel is not a Torah state, so is there a contradiction there as well? I don't think so, because I think I'll go back to the mashal that I ended with, and I ended with it on purpose. It's a difference between when you're here, you're focused on the fact that the person is dead. You're avel. You're avel in all sense in the fact that it's gone, there's really nothing to do. Over there, the baby is born. So you can look at the baby and you can say, well, wait a second. All this baby is doing is eating, crying, and relieving itself. And that's not what this is supposed to be about. It's supposed to be a human being. It's supposed to be someone who's a walking, talking, righteous person, who's a Torah figure and filled with a ben or bat Torah, and is doing chesed and tzedakah, and you know, what's this? So I'm saying in the nimshal, look how much has happened already. If I go back to the Nevi'im and I come and say, where does it start from? It starts from the fact that people come, that Am Yisrael is back, that the door has been opened, and for the first time in 2,000 years, we even have the option of coming into the classroom. So you can say, well, the kid's back into the classroom, but he's not getting A's yet. Well, okay, he just got back. Give him some time to get organized. Look how much he's back in. He walked in on his own. He's willing to come back in. He's sitting there. He's still bothering a little bit, but he's back in the room, and he's working, and he's trying. There's a reason I pointed out that there's 230,000 people sitting learning Torah. And the fact that, if you really want to get technical, that the state of Israel, without getting into whether it's correct or not correct, if it's done correctly or not, the state of Israel is pays for all religious services. That state of Israel that as you say, is not a Torah state, different topic, what exactly that is, how can it be done today, but that the state of Israel, which is not a Torah state, is allowing hundreds of thousands of people to sit and learn, is giving them money to do so. And you can say, well, it's all political. Fine, it's all political. So what? The state of Israel, officially, the state of Israel, the elected government of the state of Israel that represents the people has chosen and continues to choose every single year to pay hundreds of millions of dollars, shekels, dollars, to support yeshiva institutions. And I don't have to pay membership in Israel to a shul because it's, or to the mikveh, or to the excellent Jewish day school, which I sent my kid to, because the state of Israel does that. Is there still a lot to do? There's a tremendous amount to do. Are we anywhere near, no. Do we have Beit HaMikdash? No, there's still a lot to go. But the child is born, okay. So instead of remembering the grandfather that passed away and mourning the fact that he's gone, realize that the grandchild has been born, and go ahead, jump in. I'll stop now because I know you want to respond. How do you know it's not a mamzer? I'm trying to think of the mashal and nimshal, but you know what? Even a mamzer is a Jew. And even a mamzer tamid chach, you know what? Actually, I have a perfect answer. Mamzer tamid chacham, Kodem le Kohen Gadol Ma'aretz. Yes. Thank you. Right. Right. So what the question, you know, the question you're raising is actually very similar to what the Rashar Hirsch says. So it's an interesting question, meaning do I believe that at some point every single Jew on the face of the planet will be living in Israel and never leave? No, I don't think that's especially in today's markets. And, I think there needs to be, I imagine, I don't know, this is complete conjecture, that after we've reached the goal, or you know, some level of the goal of this, of the peak that we're dreaming of, or that has been promised and prophesized, but we're still in the stages of building. After it's built, meaning when I say it, I'm not referring just to Bet HaMikdash. I'm saying everything that goes together with Bet HaMikdash. Then okay, then Ki Mitzion Tetzorah Dvar Hashem Yerushalayim. Then go look at the model of Shlomo HaMelech, where all the nations of the world come and they revel in the wisdom. I'd imagine that there were delegations going from Shlomo. I would like to think that there were. Yes, we know that during the time of Bet HaMikdash, during Bet HaMikdash HaRishon, we know for a fact from Tanakh as well as from archaeology, but from Tanakh, that there were Jewish communities in Italy and France. We know that for a fact. I imagine that it is possible. There is situations where Jews will live outside the land of Israel. But I wouldn't use that as a raya for staying. I'd say when the day comes, when everything is built, right now we're trying to reach that peak, and we need everyone. Everyone is needed. Everyone should and can and must be part of it. And afterwards, if your work has to send you for 2 or 3 years to help and spread something, okay, you know, I'm sure when we get to that time, I'm sure you'll find the rabbi who will give you the instruction that that's the right thing to do. Thank you.